8:15, having arrived, we'll call the meeting to order. And thank you, members, for making it in on probably a slippery morning for many.
Do we have a quorum?
We have a quorum. And we have, I'm sure, some minutes. We have minutes from January 23rd and from January 24th. Do I hear a motion to approve those minutes?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertaus.
I'll move to approve both sets of minutes.
Representative Hertaus moves to approve the January 23rd, January 24th, 2013 minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote on those minutes approvals. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The minutes are approved. Today, members, we're going to hear from six more groups, and I would ask all of the groups to use about 7 minutes, 7 to 8 minutes on telling us what your program does, providing any significant data, so we can leave about an equal amount of time for questions from members. So if we could have the Minnesota Library Association, and if you would introduce yourself for the committee, and good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mark Ranum. I'm the director of the two regional library systems in West Central and Southwest Minnesota, Pioneerland and Plum Creek. I'm also the Minnesota Library Association Legislative Chair for 2013. Given your time limit, don't blink, because this is going to run pretty fast, but I have a short presentation for you, and then I can take questions if there are any. Libraries are on the forefront of early literacy activities and school success. We are the people who are dealing with parents, caregivers, and children from the very earliest all the way through post-secondary education. I want to talk just a little bit about where libraries are at and the kind of data we're using. We're using and bringing you data from some of the most respected resources, whether it's the Pew Trusts that provide nonpartisan information, all the way through academic studies on early learning and early literacy. The public priority is library funding. 91% say libraries are important. 76% say they're important to their communities. 59% have had at least one recent interaction with a public library, including 80% who say borrowing books is still important. Talking to librarians is still important. While technology is also important, you can see where the priorities lie for folks and where the costs come in for public libraries and other libraries. 82% say libraries should definitely offer free literacy programs. That's what we do. We do it day in and day out. We call them story times or lap sits or some of these other, you know, very family friendly kind of terms, but they are based in very serious, deep research, proven methods to create early literacy. In fact, Minnesota leads in early literacy. From the University of Minnesota Center for Early Education and Development, SEED, with Dr. Scott McConnell, or the Early Learning Foundation, which invested $20 million in research between 2006 and 2011, we have taken those points of research and placed them into a learning context for parents, caregivers, and for children. Early literacy is not natural. Learning to speak is an innate ability. Learning to read is not innate. That was one of the foundational issues that we tried to address with early learning and early literacy. This is the issue about you're born with 100 billion neurons, but they're not connected. By the time you're 3, you have 1,000 trillion connections. Those are the brain research numbers that you need to know, because from 0 to 3 is when it all happens. By the way, half of those are lost by the time you're an adult. I blame puberty, but that's all right. I mean, I'm just saying that half of those are lost by the time you're an adult. So when you're 3, you're at your full capacity for learning, and language learning is when that happens. You'll see I have a handout. It's got a couple of versions of the early learning skills. This is how we break it down for parents and caregivers. We talk to them about how to define and take the research and put it into practice. The kind of issues that we've got here are the kind of things you'll see in all of the programs that I'm going to talk about. Books for babies, that is connecting parents with a library card and a new book for their baby from the moment they're born in the hospital, including kits in English and Spanish. That's one of the pre-made kits that's available for libraries to use. Born to Read, this is helping expectant and new parents just get used to the idea that reading is going to be fundamental. And how those synapses are created is not just by putting kids in front of books or putting them in front of a computer screen with words on it. It's about the synaptic connections that are made when you hold a child in your lap and they have all the sensory input that's connected to the words and language that the parent or caregiver reads. We have a program called 1,000 Books Before Kindergarten. This is early literacy and milestone numbers and public recognition programs. In Edgerton, Minnesota, in 2005, when they implemented this program, they had 42 kids, according to the census, between 0 and 5. 59 kids signed up in the first 3 weeks of the program. They were drawn into this. Parents and caregivers know these programs are important. Every Child Ready to Read, this is the Public Library Association project that is a turnkey program. How did the public respond to this research? 82% say it's important for legislators to improve Minnesota children's kindergarten readiness. That's what libraries are about. And children who attend these high-quality early care and education centers leverage the over $15 billion you spend on education funding in schools. Those dollars are all affected by how well kids come ready to read. So, legislative requests. We have regional library support, both for public libraries and multi-type libraries that support the connections between schools and public libraries. Homework help. We have a proposal about providing online homework help across the state. It's available now in pockets of the state. We want to see it across the state, and we believe it's a statewide initiative. And then early and ongoing literacy funding. Those kind of funding programs that are funneled through right now into early literacy communities, libraries need dollars to help partner and bring dollars to the table. I appreciate the time of the committee this morning. I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ranum. And boy, you're a minute under time. Very nicely done.
I was hoping there'd be extra credit, Mr. Chair.
There always is. Representative Erickson.
Excuse me.
Okay. Well, Representative Grunhagen, we'll come back there, Representative Erickson.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Chair. Just, we've seen a lot of different programs on early childhood, and just one of the questions I continue to ask is, do you coordinate with any of the other programs in any way? You know, I mean, we've got so many different programs out there, and I just think coordination and looking, be much more efficient in terms of overlap and effectiveness and everything else, if you'd like to respond to that.
Mr. Anna.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, yes, we do connect with every partner in the community, and not only the partners who are engaged in early literacy, but all the way down to places where you wouldn't think about partnering. So we're partnering with food shelves to make sure that kids can pick up books. We're partnering with laundromats in Windom, Minnesota. We've got a laundromat that's offered space for books for children, and we put the same research materials in. It's not so much in my case about the overlap, because public libraries are the only place people can walk in, and absolutely anybody for free can get access to all of this expertise and all this materials. Everything else that you go into, while it might be free for some people, there are sliding scales, there are other kinds of issues. This is the no barrier, free for everyone center for this kind of early learning activity. But overlap is good in this particular case, because we want to spiral around and hit kids and parents and caregivers every place you possibly can, every day that you can, in order to make this a success.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know, sir, the relationship you have with the school libraries.
Mr. Ranum.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, the public library systems and the public libraries in these towns have connections with school libraries in the sense that the multi-type library systems connect the schools, the academic environment, and the public librarians. So, for example, we connect when the schools have a literacy initiative or a pre-K orientation for parents or any of those kind of activities. The public libraries are providing materials, providing staffing, providing support. And more than that, the school librarians understand that their jobs are critical and are becoming more critical as staffing decreases. We've lost about a third of our school librarians in the state over the past 10 years. And we know the research shows that if you have a staffed media center in your school, fourth grade reading levels increase at a much faster rate because those media centers are being used and those librarians are bringing this expertise. But I can tell you that public librarians and school librarians, and not just public schools, we also serve a very large number of private schools, a large number of, K through 8 kind of parochial schools. We serve homeschooling families like crazy in public libraries. We really are the early literacy and ongoing literacy activity for homeschoolers. And so from the point of view of how we work with formal education, Our work is to be as much of an expert as we can and partner with the experts in the schools.
And just also a point of note for members, it's been brought up, I think, a number of times, Representative Grunhagen talking about how do all of these kind of programs come together. Next Tuesday, we're going to have Karen Cadigan here from the Office of Early Learning, who kind of tries to put all that together. So hopefully she can answer some of those questions, too, and look at efforts, because I think that is important, how we can kind of put everything together, make sure it's all on the same page. So any other questions? Mr. Ranum, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Next, the Minneapolis Public Schools, AVID and Early Learning. Good morning. If you would introduce yourself.
My name is Maureen Seiwert, and I'm the Executive Director of Early Childhood for the Minneapolis Public Schools.
My name is Maria Roberts. I'm the AVID District Coordinator for Minneapolis Public Schools.
Thank you.
We're waiting for our slides to appear. You do have a copy of my slides, so we'll get started, and if our PowerPoint appears on the screen, we'll be really grateful. I wanted to start by actually saying I'm really grateful to follow this gentleman about early literacy, because we have put a tremendous amount of focus and invested a lot of resources in early literacy in the Minneapolis Public Schools, and so I'm very excited to talk about that. The slides that you have, one, the very first slide, talks about how we are organized in Minneapolis. We are organized in a slightly different way than the other early childhood programs in the state. We are part of the Office of Academic Affairs in the Minneapolis schools, and early childhood screening, school readiness, ECFE, transition to kindergarten are all in one department in the Office of Academic Affairs. The programs that are included in that, as I said, is early childhood screening and follow-up, early childhood family education, school readiness. We have two pre-K programs, one called High Five and one very small program called Three School. We have kindergarten transition and then provide early childhood professional development. We also have a lot of data. We have been doing a beginning kindergarten assessment for, I believe, about 20 years in Minneapolis under the direction of Dr. David Heisted. It is linked to our preschool screener and is also linked to our third grade MCAs. So we have a really, really good history of looking at data around literacy specifically and recently around numeracy. Some of the highlights for this year's data are we have increased, we screened about 3,949 children. We increased the screening of African American, Asian, Hispanic, and Native American children, and we maintained our percentage of three-year-olds screened. In ECFE, we have increased the participation of African American families, increased the participation of Native American families, and increased the overall participation by over 400 students. And then finally, in our pre-K program, which is High Five, we have consistent progress in literacy and numeracy over the past 3 years. I've included a number of slides. On our academic strategic plan, we have goals, and our goals are related to ensuring that the children that we serve in High Five and in ECFE and in screening are matching the demographics of our children in Minneapolis, so that our goal is to have the children in screening be exactly sort of the match of who we have in the city of Minneapolis, rather than an over-representation of high-income kids or an over-representation of one ethnic group over another. We really are interested in making sure, both for ECFE and for screening, that our numbers really reflect the city. So I've included some slides looking at the ethnicity of our children in screening. If you notice, what we pay attention to is that upward bar. The goal for screening, as an example, is there's Minneapolis, 37% of the students are African American, And 2 years ago, we were only screening 31% of our children screened were African American. So our goals on our strategic plan around ECFE and screening are related to making sure, again, across income. And so I have provided a number of slides about screening around ECFE and around the ethnicity of our children in ECFE. We also are looking at our beginning kindergarten assessment, which is that BKA that we have done for the last 20 years, at what are the trends and how are our students of color doing, how are our bilingual students doing. And so we've gotten a lot of good information. We know that, as an example, how we use our data is we know that our Spanish-speaking children coming into the district are not meeting the benchmark in language and literacy. So we're in process of actually redesigning our services for pre-K English language learners and multilingual children to ensure that we are providing them with the state-of-the-art early childhood education to meet their needs both in their home language and in literacy and English. You can see there just our results on our beginning kindergarten assessment. We have, that is one area that we're very proud. We are really seeing a reduction in the racial disparities in achievement, so that we're seeing a reduction in that gap, and that is really our goal, both in our overall beginning kindergarten assessment, and then the slide related to our beginning kindergarten assessment in High Five. We have made consistent progress, going from 72% of children meeting the total literacy benchmark to 83% this current year. If you notice, though, numeracy, this also tells us that we really need to look differently on how we are providing instruction in sort of the pre-numeracy skills, the counting and the classifying and some of the things children do in pre-K. So we also are looking, part of our strategic plan is to look at what are we doing in pre-K and how is it aligned to what kids are expected to know in kindergarten. Looking at our High Five meeting or exceeding the kindergarten the benchmark in language, looking at it by home language. As you see there, though we pointed out earlier that our Latino kids were not doing well, they are doing better in our pre-K program. The same, you know, overall we've sort of seen some leveling out here in the last year, but we have made steady progress. Conclusions, again, steady progress is being made in reducing the racial disparities in kindergarten readiness. Strategic investments in early childhood education are critical. Our district, under the leadership of Dr. Bernadia Johnson, has chosen to invest a significant amount of Title I dollars. In fact, 16% of our district's Title I revenue is dedicated to our High Five, our early childhood program. Understanding that investment early on will probably save dollars down the road as children move on into their elementary years. The integration of services within early childhood and the alignment of services within K-12 are key factors leading to our success. Our positioning and our relationship within the Office of Academic Affairs has really provided us the opportunity to fully align what we're doing pre-K into K-12. And then finally, parent engagement and education and community partners are essential. We work very closely with Head Start. We work very closely with the libraries, with the city, the county, the Northside Achievement Zone. We know that we don't serve all the children in Minneapolis. So our partners need to be as strong as we are. So we can't do one thing without them, and we also can't do one thing without their parents. So our growth and the progress we're showing, we believe, is really in part the work we're doing, but overall in part the work that the city of Minneapolis and parents and community members in Minneapolis are doing around young children and their development. Thank you.
Representative Breinert, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The data was really interesting and valuable, but I do have a data-related question, and I know your focus is on early childhood, but I'm wondering if Minneapolis is working toward longitudinal data where, because there's questions about whether early childhood learning gains are retained and what the pattern is over time and what supports are necessary. I'm wondering if you're tracking that data K-12.
Yes, we are. We have are participating in a McKnight Foundation grant, which is strongly linking pre-K through 3. I think the fact that our screening tool and our beginning kindergarten assessment are aligned to our third grade MCAs, which I think are going to be changing this year, so our data may change. But we are looking at that. We are looking at how many children we retain. We have a high mobility rate in Minneapolis, and so children we may provide early childhood to might not be with us in third grade. We are absolutely interested in the long-term look at the impact and what we need to do to strengthen K through 3. So that I say, you know, I get them ready, and so then what do we need to do to maintain? We've introduced connecting parents to educational opportunities, an ECFE-type model program for our K through 3 parents, where parents participate in parent education, and doing a lot of work around the alignment of things. So yes, we are. We do have the capability to look at children who are in our pre-K and where they're doing in third grade and even up in eighth grade.
Mm-hmm. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At a meeting last night, I was visiting with some Minneapolis parents, and they expressed a concern to me that they attend parent engagement meetings, they offer ideas, and particularly in regard to Title I, but they feel their ideas are not taken seriously, and that whomever is making these decisions just goes ahead and does what the district or the particular Title I folks have determined. So can you just share with me to what extent parents are feeling empowered in making these decisions within the Minneapolis School District?
Ms. Seibert?
I am not. I don't sit on the Title I Parent Advisory Committee. I think we do have a very extensive process where parents are engaged and their opinion is sought. Whether they, how they feel, I don't have access to that information. I think people have been very supportive of the investment in early childhood in terms of how the upper K through 12 folks are perceiving that. I don't have the answer for you, but I can get it for you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in offline, if you would provide for me the person to whom I could visit about these concerns. Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure which one. I showed as slide 9 with the BKA, beginner's kindergarten assessment. I'm curious on the, I'm seeing a shift or a drop from 09, 010 to the 2012 among American Indian and white student populations of 10 or more percent. I'm also seeing about a 5% drop from the maximum with the Asian. Was there a shift in the testing procedures? Is it a population thing? Because looking from the peak, there's only one group that goes up or maintains. The others are dropping off of a peak from around the 09, 010. And mm-hmm. Is there any data that would explain this?
No, I can go back and look into that closely. I think, we were looking at sort of the start from 2007 into where we are in 2012. We have had variations. We had one very strong year because we implemented a federal grant working with Native American students at our Anishinaabe school. So there is a lot of, every year it changes. It depends upon the percentage of students that are in the population that are taking the assessment. But overall, we feel good about the progress that we have made. But within the groups, there is, and we do analyze and look at then specific strategies for specific groups of students.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Statistically, I can see, excuse some anomalies, but a trend over several years for half and then to a lesser degree all but one would indicate either systematic or some type of testing change or a shift in, you know, some underlying. And I would assume that, especially since some of these are, you know, a four-year decreasing trend, and you get into the, you know, 10 to 17% when you're only talking, you know, 60, 70% range, that I would think would be not just statistically significant, but obviously significant. So if you can have, you know, some enlightening there, and if you don't have that information now, please get it to us so we can understand this, because I'm sure that might help us in analyzing other districts and other information.
And we need to move, we're going to move to the second part, the AVID impact. And so, Ms. Roberts, you, I guess you've got about 2 to 3 minutes. If you got, I apologize for that.
Pressure. All right. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to speak on AVID's impact in Minneapolis Public Schools. My understanding is that this group has some working knowledge of what AVID is, and so I just quickly want to remind us of AVID's mission and let you know that we have 22 sites in Minneapolis that are implementing AVID, 14 middle grades, our 7 traditional high schools, and 1 contract alternative high school. Roughly 80% of our funding comes from integration dollars. This is the criteria that AVID Center provides of who our AVID students are. AVID students apply and are selected to be enrolled into the AVID classroom. And the next several slides that I have are the demographics of who are in our AVID classrooms. This slide looks at sites, AVID sites versus the AVID classroom. We ask sites that at minimal, the AVID classroom reflects the demographics that are make up their building and that we're overrepresenting actually underrepresented populations into the AVID classroom. Based on this data, we feel confident in saying that AVID is expanding opportunities for students of color in Minneapolis, also expanding opportunities for students who receive free and reduced lunch. They, too, are overrepresented into our AVID classrooms, as well as our ELL students benefit from AVID classroom implementation. Our gender data here is reflective of the national data. Female students enroll and remain in the AVID classroom at a rate higher than male students. We in Minneapolis are not satisfied with that, so this year we've been very intentional in recruiting male students of color, specifically African American males, into the AVID classroom, and we'll look and assess the results of our recruitment efforts this spring to determine our next steps for next year's AVID enrollment. So we know that our classrooms are made up of students of color, mostly students who receive free and reduced lunch, and many ELL students, and we want to know what is the impact that AVID is having on them. So we just finished a propensity match study in our district where we match students based on the criteria listed here on this slide. Our goal was to really isolate AVID as the one thing that these students didn't have in common on paper. What we found when we looked at our AVID sites was that in grades 9 and 10, 39.9% of the non-AVID students were on track for graduation in comparison to 60.1% of our AVID students. So on track to graduate in ninth grade means that they passed the writing test and were credit appropriate, and in 10th grade it means that they passed both the reading and writing test and were also credit appropriate. We then looked at the measurement of academic progress, the MAP testing from the fall of 2011 to the fall of 2012. And once again, we find that AVID students are outperforming their non-AVID peers. And here, it's in both reading and math. We isolated and just looked at our subgroup of students of color. Once again, we can say that AVID students are outperforming their non-AVID peers in both reading and math. And based on this data, we're very comfortable saying that AVID is successfully impacting the achievement gap in Minneapolis Public Schools. The final piece of data that I'd like to share with you today is accelerated course enrollment. So we looked at, right now we're looking at all of our high schools gathering baseline data, but we had one high school that could provide us with some longitudinal data. They were one of our first high schools to implement AVID. And so if you look at this chart, the bottom two rows, those were their first graduating AVID classes. And if you compare that to the top row, you can see that not only is enrollment in the AVID class expanding, but also into accelerated coursework. And finally, this is a larger picture of this school where we can look at their 2009-2010 school year and just a school year 2 years later, how students of color, free and reduced lunch students, ELL students, and male students are enrolling at higher numbers into accelerated courses. And this school attributes that to the Avid College Readiness System and helping them to create a college-going culture for all of their students. So if we look at the data that I've shared very quickly with you all here today, we can say that Avid is providing opportunity for students of color, for our students who receive free and reduced lunch, for many ELL students, and is successfully closing the achievement gap in Minneapolis.
Ms. Roberts, thank you. We have Representative Myra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Roberts, you mentioned that there was a disparity between a male and female students. Can you comment on why that would be?
Sure.
Any idea?
Mr. Chair, Robert. And Representative Myron, that's a national trend, and so what they're finding is that they think that maybe what happens in the Avid classroom, it's a lot of organization, it's a lot of writing, it's a lot of reading, that maybe isn't as appealing to male students at this point. And so how do we create an atmosphere where males see themselves in a college-going culture, in a class that's preparing them for college? And so we're working with our sites to identify and working with our male students, what is it that stops you from wanting to enroll in Avid, or what barriers are keeping you from remaining in Avid?
Thank you. And we also have a couple questions here for Ms. Seibert. So if you would come forward that we didn't get to. So Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been listening to a lot of testimony about closing the achievement gap, and you had mentioned some data about your program indicating a high degree of mobility in the longitudinal studies. I was wondering if you had any sense of percentage of how many of your school district students are actually mobile in a society like ours today.
I know that our High Five program last year, about 10% of the students were classified as homeless and highly mobile. And I can get you what our district data is. Is it Jim Grathwell is here, our district lobbyist. He has the more total picture. We partner, actually, most of the shelters are in the city of Minneapolis, and we do screening, early childhood screening, right in all of the major shelters, and work very closely with our homeless and highly mobile team.
Mr. Chair and members, Jim Grathwell, Minneapolis Public Schools. Our December 31st count in 2012 of homeless, highly mobile kids in the city of Minneapolis is 4,140. Not all of those are enrolled in Minneapolis Public Schools. I don't have that number off the top of my head. I can get that to you. It splits about 3-1 enrolled in Minneapolis schools, and that's about 12% of our total enrollment. That's total enrollment, not early childhood.
Representative Hertas?
And so with regard to the data that you have when you do longitudinal studies, if you lose these kids along the way to mobility, are they just kind of taken away from the base, or does that reflect truly the number you started with and what the outcomes are?
Ms. Seibert.
I got that. Mr. Chair, members, Jim Grathwell again. Students have early identifying numbers and then MARS numbers. So our students move in and out of the data. So we can cut and slice that at any number of ways. For example, we do that 4-year, now we're operating off a 4-year completion rate for our graduation rate. So you measure a freshman and are they there in high school at 12th grade when they graduate. We have ways to find the students if they're in the state of Minnesota. We can still identify them in the data. It's when they leave the state that they disappear over the edge.
One more question, yeah. Quickly, please.
I was just curious if the longitudinal data that we're given, if that data is inclusive of those that you lose, or if it's artificially looking more successful than it is.
And this Ms. data Seibert. Is just of the children who participated in, it's the beginning of kindergarten after their year in our pre-K program. So all of the data that you have is like a snapshot in time of children that are entering Minneapolis Public Schools in 2007, 2008, through 2012. The same for our High Five program. So the data that you're getting is immediately following their participation in High Five. Now, the longitudinal look at how they're doing in third grade, then would be looking at how many still, and that is not included in this packet of information.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah,
we have time for one more. Representative Newton.
Briefly, Mr. Chair, thank you. Do you use integration revenue for the ECFE programs?
No, we do not.
Ms. Seibert, Ms. Roberts, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And next we have Burnsville Public Schools all-day kindergarten. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
My name is John Bonneville. I'm an elementary principal in the Burnsville Egan Savage School District, specifically at Hidden Valley Elementary. Mr. Chairman, members, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present to you about our full-day kindergarten impact and a direction we feel significantly helps improve student achievement in our schools. As referenced in the 191 Carey study that was shared with you with handouts, during the 2003-04 school year, we did implement a full-day kindergarten program for all students. Unfortunately, funding made it impossible for the district to maintain the initiative beyond the initial year of implementation, despite the positive results the full-day program was able to demonstrate. That being said, for the 2012-2013 school year, we reallocated a portion of our district compensatory funds to provide all-day kindergarten for all, making the full-day kindergarten program a district priority, with the following results. One, the full-day kindergarten program allows our kindergarten teachers more time, both formal and informal instruction that provides meaningful learning opportunities for all children and has encouraged cognitive, physical, and social-emotional development. Two, the full-day kindergarten program has provided our kindergarten teachers more time to collaborate, one, and two, to elaborate as each skill with our kindergartners develops, as well as more flexibility to move a child toward more formal instruction as he or she masters essential learnings. And three, with a portion of our children attending preschool and daycare, kindergarten is no longer the entry point to formal out-of-home education. The full-day program assures these students continuity in their early learning experiences. Full-day kindergarten for all students provides our teachers the opportunity to begin closing the achievement gap, which we've heard a lot about today, by providing children who have not benefited from pre-kindergarten learning experiences with the additional instructional focus they may need to master essential fundamental learning skills. For example, at my building, at Hidden Valley Elementary, we are a building of over 70% free and reduced lunch population. We are over 50% diverse in makeup, and over almost 40% of our students receive ESL support. If you look at just our incoming kindergartners, 50% of my students coming into kindergarten need and require ESL support. Over 50% of my students coming into kindergarten have not had any formal preschool experience, and over 50% qualify for free and reduced lunch. So there's a great need as our students are just entering kindergarten. A full-day kindergarten program allows for teachers strategically to provide interventions to support our students and close the achievement gap that first year they enter school. Hidden Valley was providing a full-day experience for our ELL students already through a program called LINK. So it was a matter of creating that type of environment for our students. And LINK was a language immersion for new kindergartners, which the goal of that was to provide intensive ESL support to bring students up to grade level performance. However, this was not available to all students, where a full-day program would be. In the 3 years that we implemented the LINK program for our ELL students, those students who exited kindergarten and entered into first grade were either at grade level, just below, or above, which is a significant difference than what we had seen in the past with our students coming in for ESL at a level 1 and 2 and not making the gains that we had hoped for. A full-day kindergarten program has a significant impact on student achievement. All students benefit, not just the few who could afford fee-based programs. Long-term, there's a cost savings as these students are not referred for special education support, title support, or are exited from such programs at a much earlier age. So as you can see, the full-day kindergarten programming is an important step in providing support for academic success for all students and for addressing that ever-present achievement gap. Thank you. Was that 5 minutes?
Bonneville, you were very, very good on that. I have one question. If you were to put, and we heard several things here, and there's a lot of data here
yes.
that I'm just kind of looking through. If you could just, in a paragraph or a nutshell, I mean, what are you finding overall on the data, on the results?
What we're finding, as I said, with our kindergartners moving into first grade and then thereafter, our students are better prepared. They are again at they're leaving kindergarten and entering first grade with their peers, same reading level, much more confident, and are students that feel really a part, much more a part of the school in the process.
And Mr. Bonneville, from kindergarten through third grade, what are you seeing? Are you seeing a continuing increase, or are you seeing a loss, a little bit of the benefits as it goes on in time?
Mr. Chairman, that's a very good question. What we have done to, and some of the data will show that there's a kind of a leveling off. However, what we have done is provide very strategic professional development for our teachers ongoing so that we can continue to maintain that progress. And our students are now are reaping that benefit and maintaining those gains.
Representative Myra, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bonneville, I am from Burnsville, and I saw this on the schedule, and so I wanted to go through it, and so I had some good reading this weekend. One of our top goals, I guess it is our top goal, is working on that achievement gap. Mm-hmm. And in the executive summary of the study, first bullet, it says findings, and this is on page 2, mm-hmm. Made growth in closing gaps between racial, language, and socioeconomic groups. I was troubled when I went in the following data, though, and looked at a number of schedules, which I'd like to draw everybody's attention to.
Sure.
If you look on page 11, members, Mr. Chair, members, this shows the racial groups. The green line, or I guess you might not have it, but the top line is white non-Hispanic students, and then there's a line for African-American students, not Hispanic. The gap between those immediately after leaving full-day kindergarten is 27%. And so they're not leaving at the same level. There is a significant gap in our children when they are leaving full-day kindergarten. And then if you look over on the far right, fall of third grade, for African, the gap between white and African-American students increases to 33%. I think this is something that should be noted. There is a greater gap, actually, between whites and Hispanic students after leaving full-day kindergarten, and that is a 34% gap right after full-day kindergarten. If you'd go to page 14, this graph talks about English language learners, and just after leaving full-day kindergarten, that first fall of first grade, there is a 22% gap between English and English language learners. And when we go to third grade, the gap widens to 27%. I think this is something that should be noted. And then also I would like to draw your attention to page 9. And this one talks about the difference of those that are in free and reduced lunch and those that are not in free and reduced lunch. And right from the get-go, after full day in kindergarten, there is a 12.4% gap between those students. And that gap increases in the fall of third grade to 12.8. So in all of these different charts on page 11, 14, and 9, there is a substantial gap after leaving full day kindergarten. And and then as you work your way down into third grade, in most cases that gap increases. I find that really disconcerting, especially since this particular report is being used to support reducing the achievement gap. Can you comment on that, please?
Mr. Chairman and members, I would say when this study was originally conducted, we did not have the professional development and those specific strategies that teachers were equipped with to meet the needs of our students. So more time in class just by itself isn't going to address that. So this is a part when you look at the full-day program. What I can share specifically related to Hidden Valley is when we looked at providing intensive support for our ELL students, we saw the gains. But that was very strategic and very intensive. And I would say the same for as we move on with our full-day kindergarten program from this point on, we are looking at systems of interventions that were not in place when this study was first conducted that address the needs of our most the kids with their most needs. So there's a lot more that's been done since then to identify exactly what strategies we need to use in working with our students.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Myra.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Bonneville. Going back to page 11, it talks about the different ethnic groups and under universal full-day cohort. Are you aware if there is information on these same groups or the control group? Were there children that remained in half day that we could see the benefit, the incremental benefit of being in kindergarten for half a day and the incremental benefit in being there the full day?
I don't have that at this point. Oh, sorry, Mr. Chairman, members. I can get that for you. I do not have it at this point.
I would greatly appreciate that.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, one last question.
Yep, Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, I noticed that there is a school board member from Burnsville in the audience that might have information on this. Is there a time when others would be able to make have public testimony on this issue?
I'm there at a later time, not today, but
okay.
Certainly later because we're running up against time.
I just wanted to.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Morgan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bonneville, thank you for coming down from the lovely city of Savage in Burnsville to visit us here at the St. Paul. I wanted to ask you, I know you said in your testimony that you are implementing, the district is implementing again a full day for everyone free program, and you're using compensatory money to do that. I'm sure that there are other uses for compensatory dollars in the Burnsville School District. In schools like yours with such high free and reduced lunch, schools like my son, Sky Oaks Elementary, with high free reduced lunch population, can you give us a sense, quick sense, how important the compensatory funding that Burnsville receives is in reducing the achievement gap in Burnsville?
Mr. Bonneville.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Morgan, it's critical. When I look at, like I said, sharing that the needs coming into kindergarten that we experience, being able to provide additional support with our interventionists in math and reading at that level, increased professional development for interventionists to, again, learn those strategies and make sure that we are being most effective with those dollars. It provides us an opportunity to, as a building, to take a look at professional development, not just at the kindergarten level, but as a building as a whole, to address the needs of all of our students. And as I shared here before, this is using compensatory for our full-day kindergarten program, it offers equity for all students within the building and within the district.
Mr. Bonneville, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. We're going to move to the next presentation, Service Employees International Union. Folks, if you would come forward. Welcome, and if you would introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Mark Cry. I'm a special ed paraprofessional in the West St. Paul School District. I'm a resident of St. Paul, and I live in House District 65A. I'm a member of the Service Employees International Union, Local 284. We represent about 8,000 school support staff across the state of Minnesota, including paraprofessional, clerical, custodial, bus drivers, food service employees inside Minnesota's public schools. Today we are also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota School Employees Association, MSEA, which represents approximately 6,000 employees across the state. MSEA shares our concerns and supports our policy proposals. I'm a special ed paraprofessional. I work at Heritage Middle School in West St. Paul. I work with 12 special need kids in mainstream academic classrooms. I've been a special ed para for about the last 10 years. It is my career. My day starts off with me arriving to school a half hour into the first hour, and when I get to class, I go talk with all 12 of the students that I work with to find out where they're at with the project that we're working on, and that takes, you know, 5 to 8 minutes. Then that gives us 10 quality minutes to do work before we have to clean up the lab that we're working on, have discussion, and get ready to move on to the next class. Now, in our district, all the special ed paraprofessionals had their hours cut 2 years ago because of budget constraints. So we either show up halfway through first hour or we leave halfway through the last hour of the day. So I have coworkers in math classes that the instructor teaches the math curriculum that day, gives some examples. They just start working with the students on the problems, and then it's time for them to leave. And then there's anywhere from 6 to 12 kids in the classroom without any help because there's no money to have the para there the rest of the day. Now, 10 years ago when I started, if there were 12 special needs students in a classroom, there were 2 paraprofessionals such as myself to help these 12 kids. And 10 years ago, we didn't arrive a half hour into the start of the school day, and we did not leave a half hour before the end of the school day. We would have had 2 paras there from the beginning of the school day until the end of the school day. And this is because of the budget constraints put upon our school district. Also, our support staff are not the only ones that have been cut. Last year, we did have administration had their cuts as well. So it's not just the bottom of the barrel people, so to speak, the lowest paid people that have had cuts made. As a paraprofessional and a member of SEIU Local 284, I am very proud of Governor Dayton's proposal to dedicate funds to special education, which would move the state closer to closing the funding gap made by cross subsidies. SEIU believes the legislature needs to do more to ensure that education has a long-term, stable source of funding that is not up for debate each biennium. This is why SEIU strongly supports the reinstitution of the general education levy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Cry, thank you. You're addressing goal number 4, special education adequacy, I think, is one of the goals you're just very good. Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Libby Kantner. I'm the political director with SEIU Local 284. And I'd just like to start by briefly giving the committee a history of the general education levy. Throughout my presentation, I'll be referencing this handout, which should be in your packets. It includes data and graphs from the Minnesota Department of Education. First enacted in 1950, the general education levy is a statewide property tax that has a unified rate. In 1971, under the Minnesota Miracle Act, an equalizing state aid component was added to the program in order to decrease the funding discrepancies between property tax poor and property tax rich districts. For example, this means if District A had a 3% tax rate and that generated $30, whereas the same tax rate in District B generated $100, the state would give District A $70 to make up the difference. In 2001, the general education levy was overturned. At the time, the state had a surplus, and the state government paid for 75% of the education budget that year, as you can see on the graph on page 1. There was a plan to pay for future years with the money generated from a sales tax proposal. However, that proposal did not pass, and the following years, the state did not have enough funds to adequately finance Minnesota schools. With no revenue coming in from the general education levy, districts were forced to go to voters with local referendums. Since the overturn of the general education levy, the number of local school levies has risen to an all-time high of 2,328 in 2014, which is on page 2. This has led to certain districts that can pass levies to pay outrageously high property taxes and other districts that cannot to make drastic cuts to their education program. The North Branch School District, for example, has tried and failed to pass 6 separate levies. Strapped for cash, they have moved to 4-day school weeks. Not helpful in this is the fact that many parents concerned for their children's education are pulling their students out of districts like North Branch and effectively taking that per pupil funding allotment to different, better funded districts. SEIU and its coalition partners believe that the best way to return to a uniform system of public schools across the state, as required by law, is to reinstate the general education levy. This would be an equalized levy. The current local levies would be folded into it, and as they're phased out, the statewide levy would take over. Governor Dayton's budget proposal provides adequate education funding for this biennium. However, the proposal does nothing to ensure education funding in the future. As you can see from the graph on page 3 of the handout, the percent of the state budget spent on education has varied drastically since 1970. Minnesota's children need a dedicated source of funding for their education that is not in jeopardy with each legislative session. The general education levy would provide this. Not only would general education levy address the need for long-term, stable education funding in Minnesota, it would also work to equalize education funding across the state, one of this committee's goals. The adequacy of our children's education should not be based on their address, and yet, over the past 12 years, that is exactly what has happened. The graph on page 4 illustrates the funding disparity between the highest funded districts in the state and the lowest. As you can see, the disparity has been rising since 2006. And then finally, before I turn it over to our executive director, Carol Meters, I'd just like to make one final point. The general education levy, as proposed by the working group, has a zero levy target, meaning that statewide there'd be no change in the bottom line of property taxes. Additionally, for 63% of school districts, the general education levy would mean property tax relief. Please look in your packet for what this would mean for the school districts in your region. These calculations are based on the education working group's recommendations, which you'll be hearing more about tomorrow from Dr. Melcher. Now, I'd like to turn it briefly over to Ms. Meters to talk about how the reinstitution of the general education levy would affect SEIU's members and Minnesota's children.
Thank you, Ms. Cantor. And Ms. Meters, if you could, just a minute or two, please, so I could get to some questions. Thank you.
Chair Mark Burton, committee members, my name is Carol Meters, the executive director. And our members are not just the support staff in school, but parents, grandparents, and community members. Mark's story really highlights that he shared the experience of a child 10 years ago to today. 6-1 classroom assistance as opposed to 12-1. That also impacts every other student in the school. But the broader picture is what's happening to kids that first hour and last hour of the day where they're only getting a few minutes of help. And the parents at the end of the day are wondering why their children aren't succeeding where others are. So I want to just kind of add to that on a recent story that another of our members, an executive board member, actually told about her child's experience. Her child, two kids born 4 years apart, needed help in the school district. Her first child graduated 4 years ago and was able to get out of the special ed program and mainstream by high school level. Her son now is a senior in high school and has never had that same ability and still requires assistance. His ability to feel successful and move on to the next level of education and where he's going to be in life may be significantly different because of the experience that he had. North Branch, we've got a number of members that work there but live there who've had to make a decision to move their kids out of that school district because going to 4 days is the wrong direction. Kids need more and not less. And those are not just our members' stories, but I would say, as you listen to folks in your constituencies, they're Minnesota stories. As a union leader, I also have to address the cost of this in our members' lives by the lack of funding. Many have experienced year after year of reduced take-home pay due to health insurance costs not outpacing wages, but in many cases, many have not even had wage increases, that there's been year after year of wage freezes. Our paraprofessional groups, direct assistance to students, are our highest turnover member base in our union. Staff turnover has a direct impact on the quality of education kids have as they receive development and other training to help kids succeed. We have got to do better for our kids, for our workers, to have a graduation rate that improves. Our union has four locals in Minnesota that is very diverse in membership. And so as graduation rates, I just saw some numbers yesterday of Caucasian students at around 80% and children of color at 50% or below. I would bet when parents are looking at children in the birthing centers, they're not looking at saying one in every two of these children of color are not going to succeed with the way we're set up now. We've got to do better, and this is our opportunity to do that. And that's why we support the general education levy and why we also support Governor Dayton's proposal on early learning investment. And we do support all-day kindergarten for all Minnesota students to give them the basis to succeed. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious for the testifier for the SEIU. Regarding the general education levy and the governor's budget, it was mentioned that you were very pleased with the governor's budget. And Chairman yourself was pleased with the governor's budget as well. Although there's a great missing component of his budget, which is this goal's, if not number one, number two, or three's primary goal and responsibility of this committee is that to shorten up that disparities in our funding. And yet the governor's budget does nothing at all to address those funding disparities amongst many school districts across the aisles, and yet your organization supports it 100%, but this is our number one goal, and I'm just surprised that you haven't mentioned it and wondered what your take is on that.
Representative McDonald, it's one of our goals, not number one goal. Looking at this, I don't think we really ranked them necessarily, but it is one of our goals, certainly. So just...
Well, at least we had number one in there.
Right.
One
okay.
of our goals.
It's one of our goals, one. Right. So who wants...
I'll address that, Chair. I would say if you look at a statement or a release that I had the day of the governor's budget, it was that we were in support of the governor's budget overall, but that we really felt like there that was a starting place, and you folks in the legislature will have an opportunity to make changes as needed within that. And so I did say in that statement that we did support the task force recommendation of the general ed levy, which is included in that.
Representative McDonald.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I guess you're right. I did say number one, but I also followed up with it could be number two or three, but I guess we didn't number them, and maybe that's a good thing for discussion. Well, thank you. What is your name?
Carol Neeters.
Thank you, Ms. Neeters. Yes, well, but in the general education funding, in their findings, nothing is addressed to close up that disparity gap whatsoever, and mm-hmm. I was really hoping that that would be a part of it and wondering if in your organization you can help alleviate that funding disparities.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Peters?
I would say that there are different places within the governor's budget that do create dollars, and so there's a property tax, I think it's a $500 property tax relief. Is there a way to look at some of that, even a portion of it, to work towards closing the gap in equity? And that's what we're working on.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe this would be Ms. Cantor, since it's on these graphs that were given. On page 3, where you show the education as a portion of the state general fund, because HHS spending is growing at much greater rate than any other component in the state budget, I think it'd be more enlightening for us to have this with HHS funding backed out, and then we can see that, more accurately. And then going on to page 4, I just want to be assured that any building funds, because a district that has to replace a building that's old or had asbestos, etc. issues is not in this, because having been on a school board, I know that you can't take building dollars and use that to augment instruction, even though where we have students learn does have some impact. So I'd like to understand if that was just classroom and student funding, or does this include any of the referendums for buildings?
Ms. Cantor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, like I said, the Department of Education put together these graphs, but I'd be happy to look into them and get you that information.
Very good. Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, the graph on the back is the statutory definition of how to measure this gap, and this is just components of general education and referendum. So it's basically the basic revenue and referendum. There's no building money in this comparison.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Chair. Then it must be the fact that many of my schools in my district are below the fifth percentile. In fact, my own is in, you know, low in the one percentile for funding, because what I see in disparities from you know, major districts and ours is in the upper 50s for percent. And so it might be nice if we could get a you know, breakdown of what the actual max, and then have that weighted by number of students, because I do notice that there are a few very large districts which tend to be in the 95th or above. So when you're talking per pupil funding and you do it by district, I don't think you get a true you know, comparison. If you don't have what it actually is, you've got 20% of your students are funded here, you know, and these students down here. And I would, you know, silly me used to think that efficiencies of scale mattered, and that's why we had Zumber Education District and other special ed districts that combined the smaller ones so that they could make up for not having the critical mass. And so when we do look at the disparities, we do look at what is required to fund and educate our students, that we have a fuller, complete picture that doesn't quite show up in these graphs. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Strom, could you put together a run that could go from the highest, based off the numbers they're using off here, to the, yeah, the lowest with the number of
Mr.
pupil
Chair,
count?
Glad to.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks for being here. And if we'll move to the YMCA after school programs. Welcome, and if you would introduce yourself.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for my name is Jenny Wright Collins, and I'm the network director for the Minneapolis Beacons Network. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today on behalf of the YMCA of the Greater Twin Cities and the Minneapolis Beacons Network. YMCAs across the state provide all kinds of opportunities for young people to learn after school, in child care centers, and in camps. But today, specifically, I'll be talking about our public-private partnership in Minneapolis called the Minneapolis Beacons Network. The YMCA is the lead and fiscal agency for this partnership. And it's a collaborative of the organizations you see the logos for on the bottom of the screen. So the YMCA, the Boys and Girls Clubs, the Minneapolis Community Education Department, the YWCA of Minneapolis, as well as the Minneapolis Public Schools. And this effort is in part funded by the 21st Century Funds administered by the State Department of Education. Minneapolis Beacons engages youth as leaders and learners by transforming schools into active youth centers after school and in the summer. Just a brief profile of what we do in our after school and summer opportunities. We're engaging nearly 4,000 K through 12th grade students this year in Minneapolis alone at 11 schools, employing over 100 community staff and over 50 young people, leveraging $3 for every $1 invested through collaboration and partnership. We're partnering with over 60 organizations and agencies. In addition to the lead agencies that run the centers, we also partner with, at each center, as many as 20 local community businesses and partners. This effort is funded through public and private funding, including the 21st Century federal funds I mentioned, as well as funders including the Greater Twin Cities United Way, Youth Prize, and other corporate and foundation partners. So it's truly a public-private partnership. Our vision is that youth will succeed as 21st century leaders and learners. Our goals include youth attending school regularly, succeeding academically, and graduating from high school, that youth will develop a commitment to community and service, a commitment to lifelong learning, and that youth will demonstrate 21st century skills for college, work, and life. So just to briefly touch on what a model is, we transform schools into youth centers through a partnership between a youth development organization and a school. So this is a truly integrated partnership where an organization such as the Boys and Girls Club comes into the school building and helps transform it into a youth center during the non-school hours. So after school and in the summer, really blending together the best that the school has to offer and the best that a community organization has to offer. And I know you want to hear about data today, so I'm going to move pretty quickly here into some of our results from our after-school programs through Minneapolis Beacons. But first, I wanted to just briefly touch on what some of research tells us about after-school programs. We know that after-school programs are critical support for learning. It's an honor to follow colleagues who speak about early learning, and I think after-school programs are a great continuation of the supports that young people need K through 12 in order to be prepared for college and beyond. After-school programs have been proven to lead to outcomes for young people, including increasing school attendance, improving reading and math scores, and improving health and civic engagement and other outcome areas. But we know a few things are necessary for those outcomes to be achieved. One is that programs have to provide access, particularly for young people who would not otherwise have access to these opportunities. We call that the opportunity gap. Low-income young people and young people of color in Minnesota are less likely to have access to opportunities in the after school and in the summer. And if they do have access to those opportunities, they're less likely to perceive them as high quality. So we have an opportunity gap. And programs that are going to achieve outcomes for young people need to close that by providing access. They also need to be high in quality, they need to ensure frequent participation of young people, and they need to demonstrate strong partnerships. And for those focused on academic achievement, particularly strong partnerships with schools. Regarding Beacons, one of our approaches to quality is we do a regular quality assessment, and we have a rigorous quality improvement cycle that we use. The Youth Program Quality Assessment Tool is a research-validated tool that many after-school programs across the country are beginning to adopt. And I'm going to move just quickly into our results. So we conduct an annual external evaluation in partnership with Blue Water Associates and with the Minneapolis Public Schools Department of Research, Evaluation, and Assessment. And we've been doing this for almost 15 years. So what I'll share with you today is a summary of some of the results we've seen in these annual evaluations. We see the Beacons participants are showing increased outcomes in areas including we're increasing school attendance, increasing academic achievement, increasing school and community connectedness, increasing 21st century skills for college, work, and life, and increasing access to and participation in high-quality out-of-school time opportunities for youth from low-income communities. So Beacons is certainly closing the opportunity gap. We provide regular engagement of Minneapolis Public Schools youth impacted by disparities in achievement. Last year, we served over 3,000 youth from low-income communities, and this year we're expanding, so our program is serving nearly 4,000 young people this year. 93% of Beacons participants are students of color. 90% are on free or reduced lunch, and 70% participate 30 days or more, which is the definition that the department participate 30 days or more, which is the definition that the Department of Education, federal and state, use for regular participation for after-school programs. We're also increasing school attendance. This is a study conducted by Dr. David Heistad, who was at that time with the Minneapolis Public Schools Research and Evaluation and Assessment Department. In every single Beacon Center assessed at that time, there was a statistically significant increase to school attendance based on, he did a comparison of what would have been projected for each of those participants based on prior school attendance and based on demographics, and found a significant, statistically significant rates in every single Beacon Center, leading him to conclude that Beacons is dramatically improving at school attendance for young people. We're also improving school performance. Students who attended Beacons for more than 90 days were twice as likely to be proficient in reading based on the MCA results. I wanted to share this slide to illustrate, this is based on math gains, but I wanted to tell a particular story to illustrate the importance of schools partnering with the community to achieve academic results for their students. If you see in the middle, Nellie Stone Johnson School is featured in this particular slide, and it's showing dramatically higher results in math gains compared to some of the other schools, even as high as 15% higher than others. And we know that this year when these results were achieved, we had a new principal who had come into a school that was fresh started. And at that time, the students who returned to school in that fall didn't recognize any single adult in the school. Every single adult had changed, had been laid off, and new staff had been hired, with the exception of the one YMCA employee. And that one YMCA employee partnered closely with the new principal, who saw her as an asset because of her relationships with the young people and the families. And together, they used the after-school program that year to dramatically accelerate the academic gains that the school day was also seeing. So we know that when a community-based organization, such as the YMCA or the Boys and Girls Club, partners closely with the school, we can achieve accelerated academic results. We also talk to our young people. Beacons is all about engaging young people as leaders in their communities as well, so we ask them what they think. And we surveyed thousands of young people in grades 5th through 12th who attended the programs regularly. And 98% said, I feel welcome here. In the interest of time, I'll skip to the bottom and say 94% said, what we do here will help me in my future. We also surveyed over 1,200 teachers. And we found that the results, which we can compare to programs across the country, were up to 20% higher than the results we saw from teachers around the country responding to 21st century programs. Teachers said 96% of teachers indicated that participation and volunteering in class had improved for the student. 90% indicated that school performance and motivation to learn had improved for the participating student.
Ms. Collins, if I could ask you to finish up in about 1 minute
here. Absolutely. So this is the last slide. I wanted to quote quote from one of our evaluations from Blue Water Associates that says, Beacons has been a stabilizing force in some of the most unstable schools and neighborhoods. They continue to make an impact on the students most at risk in the schools where the need to increase attendance, motivation to learn, and learning is the greatest. And I wanted to just share a brief story to say that I started working with the program actually when I myself was a Minneapolis Public Schools graduate and was at school at the University of Minnesota as an intern. And some of the young people that I met at that time as a program staff are now still involved with the program, many of whom have graduated from college. And one young woman who actually came to testify at the state about 10 years ago on behalf of Beacons as a third grader at the time, is now an AmeriCorps staff working in one of our newest Beacons in a high school and is giving back to her community having graduated from college. So this just truly has a powerful impact, after school programs and partnerships with schools and community. So thank you.
Ms. Collins, thank you so much. Any questions? Representative Selzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, and it was so nice to hear that one of your college graduates is now giving back to the program. As you work with these students, is there any coordination with the school counselors that often have a high student-to-counselor ratio as far as encouraging or helping these students access post-secondary options?
Ms. Collins.
Thank you, Representative. Absolutely, and in fact, we recently expanded from one high school to three this fall, and so we originally started as more of an elementary to middle school model, and we found we were getting such great results of engagement and buy-in with our middle school students who others were finding difficult to reach that we began to extend our work into the high schools in Minneapolis. And so as we've done that work, we've connected more with programs such as Check and Connect, with school counselors, and with a host of partners who are really skilled in college readiness and college access. So because it's a collaborative partnership, we really coordinate closely with all the partners in the community doing that work.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And thank you so much
for
all your efforts. Sounds like you're doing wonderful things there.
Thanks. So much.
If we could move to St. Paul Public Schools, high school redesign, our final presenters.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. If you would introduce yourselves, and if you have about 7 minutes, so we'd allow about 3 minutes for questions before we have
all
to
right,
end.
We're
so
going to move this along.
All right. Thanks so much.
As quick as we can. Anyways, welcome. I'm Doug Rausbeck. I'm the principal at St. Paul Harding High School. Along with me is Louis Francisco, who's our instructional coach. And just want to thank you from the past 2 years ago for visiting Harding. It was very memorable. And for those of you who are there, our students really did learn a lot, and I'm sure to this day we'll remember that quite some time. I'm also aware that about a week ago you heard from our early learning program. Today you get to hear about the other side, the exit side, the high school experience. And I'll talk to you a little bit about Harding, which is one of the largest Title I funded schools in the state, if not the largest. We're about 2,000 students, and we're pretty close to the 3M building over there. And the years ago, probably our seniors from last year, here's some data from that same group when Harding back in 1999-2000. You'll notice back then we were 39% Asian, and Caucasian was about 43%. And our other subgroups around 10, 5, and 3%. So there was quite a few changes from the early 90s to about 99, and then today. Well, before I get to today, I want to mention a little bit about our free and reduced. Back in this time here, we were at 55% free and reduced lunch, and it was capped out 2 years ago at 91%. Our school was at 91% 2 years ago. Now we're down to 86%. So our current situation with our school at Harding is we have about 14% of our students are special education. English language learners, about 30%. In our entire high school district, we had 1,500 new students to the high schools, where half of them are English language learners, which means they have to receive some form of ELL support when they come into the district. Harding High School, with the students that we have there, about 70% of them have a second language at home. And keep in mind that many of those 30% of our students are English language learners. One of the things I want to also mention is that there's 42 different languages at Harding. The most common language is Hmong. Most of our kids coming to Harding now are Spanish-speaking. They're from Thailand. A lot of Korean students. Probably the biggest changes we're seeing now is for the Myanmar area, former Burma. Many Korean and Korean language students seem to be coming in here to St. Paul to become part of our school district as well. So what I'm here to do is invite Louis to say a little bit after I talk about my data wall here, but we're going to talk about a seven-year journey and the shifts in a school, a very large turnaround model, in a matter of a few minutes here, to share with you how a school has literally changed culturally within the building. Changing school culture is what it is all about. All turnaround work is about changing the way teachers and adults work with young people. So what you're seeing here is a data wall that's on my blackboard. This is changed regularly based on testing results. Below the 11th grade, when you look at 10th and 9th grade, those are that's the data points of the predictor data. When students come in, they don't take the MCAs until, you know, like the writing in 9th grade and the reading in 10th grade, but we have predictable data to help us sort out and find out best ways to meet their needs in the building. And you'll see kids walking in the door, the red circles, 372 of our 504 students are predictable right now to be below standard on the MCA reading for 10th grade. It's a major, major effort in our school to keep track of every single student. When they walk in the door, we hit the ground running with all kinds of supports built into our school, and it's extended day and so on, and Louis will talk about that. But then you'll see how things change over the years with reading and writing as they retake and retake and retake. Some of our students, by the time they're senior, they've taken the reading test 12, even 15 times. After the first time they take it, we see over half of our students are passing first time around in 10th grade with reading, and after that we see a trend of about 15 to 17% every time. It's much more challenging after that first passing happens, if they pass or not pass. We're seeing trends throughout the state. This isn't just a St. Paul data point, it's also around the state. Very difficult, because now we're dealing with the challenges of students new to the country. For the most part, are they able to pick up on that language? So at that point here, I'm going to move it on to Louis. He's going to talk a little bit about other trend data and some of the work going on in our literacy work at Harding.
Mr. Francisco, welcome.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Louis Francisco,
and I am an instructional coach, literacy coach, and also a reading teacher at Harding High School. And also I'm in a lot of leadership programs that we create some programs for students extended in their education throughout the day. And it's the most importantly, I graduated from Harding High School in 1991. So the transformation of Harding High School with instruction of instructions in the classroom and also the student learning is something to behold in the past many, many years. And it was kind of a pleasure of seeing that throughout those years. One of our main focus at Harding is literacy. And as a coach, I have the firsthand experience of working with the teachers and co-teaching with them and planning with them and embedding literacy strategies in their content area, which is a challenge. And also making sure that our students are learning. There's learning research-based strategies that they can take outside the content area in classrooms. And most importantly, what we preach to them is that all these strategies that they're learning is that they can take also in college. They can use them in college because at one point they're going to read something that is very challenging and they have a tool that they can take that they learned from Harding High School and they can access the text that they are reading. So the graph in front of you is basically the last 5 years, our journey in terms of literacy at Harding High School. In 2007, we had our inception of our writing initiative at Harding where we had a building-wide writing initiative where we stopped for the entire day, the entire school write a writing prompt. And we all have a common grading back in the days, the 2008, 9, and 10, We do the writing prompt three times a year. Now it's only two times a year, but we stop and we as a staff, we grade the students' writing, and we agree with whether they're proficient, not proficient, or we need a lot of work. And we based on those writing prompts, we make adjustments of our instructions, and we meet all our students' needs in terms of writing. If you see in 2011, we took a little dip there from 75% to 69%. And then we have a big jump from 2011 to 2012 to 80%. Now, these are the students that are taking it for the first time at ninth grade. And we made an adjustment as a staff, and we decided instead of having students write a paragraph, we had them write essays. And with our professional development structure kind of lends into our collegial collaboration of learning from each other. And we jump from 69% to 80% with the reading, and we have a lot of challenges with the reading. But the best thing about this is that we have incremental gains. Even though with the challenge that we have incremental gains from 2008 to 2012. And from 2008, I was one of the reading teachers at Harding. Now we have 10 reading teachers at Harding High School, and we're ensuring that we have reading in all grade levels. Making sure that even though the reading test is done in 10th grade, we can't leave the students behind who are not proficient in reading. So we made sure, and with our leadership supporting that we have reading at all grade level. So.
One other point here: the main thing about improving literacy in a large high school or any school for that matter is everybody has to own it. And it's very challenging at the high school level compared to an elementary level. Teachers at high school, it's about the content. And I want to repeat, it is about the content. Very hard to embed literacy. It's go slow to go fast. And working in schools and high schools, one of the largest cultural changes of any high school is to embed strategies that are literacy-based strategies, research-based literacy strategies, so that students understand. And when you look at the Common Core coming forward, it is really about literacy, and we're going to see more and more about that. You'll recognize that in the future as well. And then other instructional supports, Lee?
Yes. Well, also, I was in back then it's called ESL. I was an ESL student at Harding High School, 20 years ago. Now it's ELL. I wish I can go back and be an ELL student now because of all the good work that is happening at Harding High School. Then my road, to where I am now, I've been teaching for 18 years now, would have been a little bit more smoother because of the teachers are teaching us all our students a lot of strategies and how to tackle these challenging texts the students are getting. But we have instructional supports at Harding High School. I would like to highlight a couple of things on this, and you have it in
Mr.
your...
Mr. Francis, we have about 30 seconds left for the meeting time, so just anything to finish off there. And I'm sorry to cut this short, but yes. We're just running out of time.
Can we move along?
Yeah,
okay.
Move along, yeah.
Let's move along. Simply put, on this graduate piece, you'll see comparative data from Harding and the others across the state. We're very similar. The biggest challenge we have here is our year 5 and 6 students who are ELL. You'll see the 118 right there. That is the number much higher than other schools because many of our students do not pass the test. 40 of our seniors did not pass the reading test last year. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of our greatest challenges is the year 5 and 6 ELL student. Otherwise, you see an exemption a lot for the kids who are up under that 5 years. And finally, what makes a difference? The bottom line is the focus on literacy, embedded time for teachers. If we can't talk to each other, we're not going to get better. And an enormous amount of our resources go into teacher development. So the collaboration is huge. Time for students built into the day, extended day, summers, so on. A lot of data use, very focused on data. Teacher leadership just needs to grow and grow and grow. If you don't have a 30-year staff leading the way, then we're not going to get better. On the bottom line, like I mentioned before, the culture shift is from content to ensuring learning, and that is very difficult in high schools because it's about loving our content, very hard to do. So finally, district results at the very bottom, 4-year grad rate steadily increasing across the entire district. Again, at the bottom, another related grad rate, a 4-year graduation rates increased for all. There's the racial disparities. You can see under the far right, achievement gap narrowing. Still not there yet. We have a long way to go, but you can see it getting better.
And Mr. Rethbeck and Mr. Francis, attest members will look at this data.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Apologize for cutting you off short, but
I understand. Well,
have a good rest of the
listening.
School year.
Appreciate being able to come in to share.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And members, tomorrow we're going to be listening to the Education Finance Task Force report, and we're going to start and spend about the first 15 minutes looking over a spreadsheet on the governor's budget. So we'll do that. We didn't have a chance to do that the other day. So with that, we are adjourned. Thank you, members.
All right, I mean, there's some
exactly right.
Pretty high.
That's what they come in.
We're seeing how much money we're spending.